I'm Sue O'Brien for 1029 CHTM. Today my guest is Jim Wilson with the Canadian Lyme Disease Foundation. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you.
How did the Canadian Lyme Disease Foundation come to be?
Well, I contracted Lyme disease in 1991 in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, and was sick for a number of years before I finally got a proper diagnosis and treatment. So I was aware of how devastating the illness can be and how difficult and lengthy the treatment can be. But the treatment is extremely successful in many cases if it's allowed to unfold. Then in 2001, we had moved to British Columbia at that time. My daughter and other children in our neighborhood contracted Lyme disease here in BC. And up to that point, you know, I was told in Canada this was a very rare disease. So that coincidence of two members of one family a decade apart getting this rare disease 5,000 kilometers apart, to me, was just too much of a coincidence to swallow. So I looked into it further, and what I found out, that the only thing that was rare in Canada was the diagnosis, not the disease.
Jim, Lyme disease has really gained notoriety in the last few years, but many of us still don't know that much about it. First off, what is Lyme disease and what causes it?
Well, it's a bacterial infection typically acquired from a tick bite. It's a spirochetal bacteria, which is of the same family as the syphilis bacteria. And spirochete comes from the spiral shape of the organism. And it's called a Borrelia. So Lyme disease is really a borreliosis, an infection with Borrelia bacteria.
And what are the signs and symptoms that a person might have the disease?
Well, that's the complex part of this and makes it difficult. Some people will initially get an identifiable rash. The majority will not. And some people may come down with initial flu-like symptoms, but a lot of people will not. Typically, if you don't get the initial flu-like response, it will be just a slow progression of symptoms over a period of time. And it could take weeks, months, or even years later for those to develop. And it's a multi-systemic disease, so it can affect all systems of the body, from the brain to the heart to the joints to the muscles to the bowels, the eyesight, hearing. So it can become very complex, and this is why when the medical system is trying to deal with this, we have to look at the whole body. We can't continue to do what we have been doing, which is sending you to a cardiologist for your heart issue, sending you to a gastroenterologist for your bowel problem, sending you to a rheumatologist for your joints and muscle aches. It should be in that realm of internal medicine, really, because that particular field looks as the more holistic perspective of the human body. And this is really where this needs to be.
How can somebody get a definitive diagnosis? Is there a particular test, or is it just a matter of, you know, some doctor managing to put together the pieces of the puzzle and saying, this is what you have?
The testing right now is serological testing, and it's really rife with problems. The testing is limited to only one strain of one species of the Borrelia bacteria, when we know through the research of many Canadian researchers and researchers around the world, we have many strains of this bacteria. So we have a problem right off the bat. If you happen to have an infection with one of the strains of Borrelia that our current testing is incapable of looking for, then you're going to be false negative every time. There's been too much reliance in our medical guidelines on this antibody test. And it can also be a poor test because it is dependent upon the individual's body mounting a detectable immune response. But we're all different in how our immune systems function. You couple that with the fact that we have many strains of the organism, it makes it a very poor test, and it really can't be relied on. The disease has to be clinical based on symptoms and history. You cannot then use the laboratory to confirm your suspicions, because it will not. If the test comes back negative, it tells you nothing, because all it says is you didn't mount a detectable immune response to that specific strain of the organism. It tells you nothing about whether or not you've been exposed to other strains or whether you just have a weak immune system to that particular bacteria. That leaves it right in the hands of a clinical diagnosis.
What's the impact for somebody for not getting an early diagnosis?
Well, it can be devastating because, as I mentioned previously, it affects every system of the body. So you can become extremely disabled. And that's the problem we have in Canada right now. We are missing this disease in the thousands in the early stage. So we have thousands of people now across Canada who are chronically ill. They're unable to get a proper diagnosis and unable to access proper treatment. And this is why so many Canadians have really gone bankrupt as a result of their illness. And in many cases, they've had to travel to the United States to access proper care. And this is 2015. This disease has been around for 40 years that we've been aware of. Canada is lagging way behind the rest of the world in this.
And what are some of the treatments that are effectively being used to control or cure the disease when someone has it?
The only truly effective treatment is antibiotic. And if it's caught in the early stages, then 3 or 4 weeks of antibiotics will usually knock it down. But that's in the very early stages. Once it's allowed to disseminate into the system, and that can occur in just 24 hours or 48 hours, then it can become a longer-term antibiotic regimen, similar to many other diseases like tuberculosis.
And there's the downside of taking antibiotics for a long period of time as well.
The patient have to be able to have all of the information from their medical practitioner to measure the risk versus benefit of the treatment. That's really what's lacking in that doctor-patient relationship right now, is that transfer of information to the patient, because the doctor doesn't even have that information in Canada.
Which areas in Canada are seeing the most reports of Lyme disease?
Well, Quebec, Ontario, Nova Scotia, and southern Manitoba, those are the most highly endemic areas, but it can be contracted anywhere in Canada. So long as you have robins coming to your neighborhood in the spring, and your wrens and finches and the other migratory passerine birds, then you're at risk of having Lyme disease in your area, because it's these birds who not only carry the disease in their blood to infect ticks that jump aboard, they carry these ticks thousands of miles. Researcher John Scott from Ontario identified a tick in Grand Prairie, Alberta, that was originally only known to occur in Brazil. These ticks are being moved around randomly, and according to the Public Health Agency of Canada research that came out a few years ago, they're being moved around in the hundreds of millions per season, these ticks. There is nowhere where you're immune from contracting Lyme disease.
And you did mention southern Manitoba. We're here in northern Manitoba, where I'm calling you from. So obviously we have lots of people from our region going down south, visit family, do camping and stuff like this. So basically everybody should be aware and be taking some precautions. And now, what kind of precautions can people take?
Once you're aware that these ticks are out there, then understand their habitats. They like tall grass, short brushy areas. They need to be in a shaded, moist environment. So leaf litter and grass litter, they can get underneath that and have a nice, humid, warm environment where they can thrive. So stay out of tall grass and brushy areas. If you're hiking, stay in the middle of the path. Don't brush up against the edges, because when a tick is looking to feed, they crawl up a blade of grass or up to a short brush, usually no more than about 18 inches off the ground, and they will put their little Velcro-like claws out and latch onto the first warm-blooded CO2-breathing mammal that comes along, because they sense your CO2 that you breathe out. Once they have latched on, well, then they just very quickly can migrate to an area up your pant leg or down your waistline, or crawl up to the neckline and then get access to the skin that way. So the other thing is to use products. There's some good natural products, and there's other products that contain DEET. And even if you don't want to spray your skin, at least spray the points of entry, where the pants meet the socks, where your belt line is, where your neckline is, where your wrists meet your clothing.
And if someone is looking for more information on Lyme disease, where should they go, Jim?
Go to the Canadian Lyme Disease Foundation's website, CanLyme, CanLyme.com or .org, and they can access some very good information there.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about this, Jim?
We have to have the governments start to work closer with the patient groups. We are working with scientists on 4 different continents, and we have got to be brought into this discussion. We have got an awful lot to offer, and we can be doing a heck of a lot better job at this if we just get together.
Well, thanks for your information and advice, Jim. I know that Lyme disease isn't anything to ignore, and the best way to prevent it is to be aware and be careful.
And be aware up in the Thompson area that a robin could be in a highly Lyme endemic area of Wisconsin, Minnesota, or southern Manitoba and be in your backyard in Thompson the next day carrying these infected ticks.
Well, it's funny you say that because there's a robin I see flying around my backyard on quite a regular basis, and I've always been thinking, oh, it's really nice to see a robin, but maybe now I'll rethink that.
Another good thing is perhaps rethink having bird feeders around, those people who do.
Well, that's another good warning, another good thought. All right, thanks very much, Jim.
Thank you.
For this edition of Thompson Today on 102.9 CHTM, I'm Sue O'Brien.